But the road is open, I asked.
So far.
You mean it might flood?
Always a possibility.
And if it floods, we're stuck in the middle of nowhere.
He looked at me with a touch of pity.
Mister, you're already in the middle of nowhere.
The point was inarguable. Cairns was 1,100 miles from Brisbane, its own state capital, and there was nothing in the other directions but ocean, jungle, and desert.
But Palm Cove's real nice, he added. You'll like it.
And he was right. Palm Cove was lovely, really quite astonishingly so. It was a purpose-built village inserted with some care into a stretch of tropical luxuriance beside a curving bay. On one side of a beachside road stood low-rise hotels and apartments, a few cottages and a scattering of bars, restaurants, and shops, all discreetly obscured by palms, spreading fronds, and flowering vines, and on the other was a palm-lined walk overlooking a smooth golden beach and the sea. Our hotel was, in everything but name, setting, and price, a motel, but it was friendly and overlooked the sea. We claimed our rooms, then went for a walk along the beach. A few other people were strolling over the sand, but no one was in the water, and for a very good reason. It was the height of the season for box jellyfish, also known in Queensland as marine stingers, or just stingers. By whatever name they go, these little bubbles of woe are not to be trifled with. From October to May, when the jellyfish come inshore to breed, they render the beaches of the tropics useless to humans. It is quite an extraordinary thought when you are standing there looking at it. Before us stood a sweep of bay as serene and inviting as you would find anywhere, and yet there was no environment on earth more likely to offer instant death.
"So you're telling me," said Alan, for whom all this was new, "that if I waded into the water now, I would die."
"In the most wretched and abject agony known to man," I replied.
"Jesus," he muttered.
"And don't pick up any of the seashells," I added, stopping him from leaning over to pick up a seashell. I explained to him about cone shells, the venomous creatures that lurk inside some of the handsomest shells, waiting for a human hand to sink their vile pincers into.
"Seashells will kill you?" he said. "They've got lethal seashells here?"
"There are more things that will kill you up here than anywhere else in Australia, and that's saying a lot, believe me." I told him about the cassowary, the flightless, man-sized bird that lives in the rainforests, with a razor claw on each foot with which it can slice you open in a deft and appallingly expansive manner, and the green tree snakes that dangle from branches and so blend into the foliage that you don't see them until they are clamped onto a facial extremity. I mentioned also the small but fearsomely poisonous blue-ringed octopus, whose caress is instant death, and the elegant but irritable numray, which moves through the water like a flying carpet, discharging 220 volts of electricity into anything that troubles its progress, and the loathsome sluggish stonefish, so called because it is indistinguishable from a rock, but with the difference that it has 12 spikes on its back that are sharp enough to pierce the sole of a sneaker, injecting the hapless sufferer with a myotoxin bearing a molecular weight of 150,000.
"And what does that mean, exactly?" Alan asked.
"Pain beyond description, followed shortly by muscular paralysis, respiratory depression, cardiac palpitations, and a severe disinclination to boogie. You might similarly be discommoded by firefish, which are easier to spot but no less hurtful. There's even a jellyfish called the snotty."
"You're making this all up," he said, but without conviction.
"Oh, but I'm not." Then I told him about the dreaded saltwater crocodile, which lurks in tropical lagoons, estuaries, and even bays such as this one, leaping from the waters from time to time to snatch and devour unsuspecting passers-by. Just up the coast from where we now strolled, a woman named Beryl Ruck had been taken not so long before, in a startling manner.
"Shall I tell you about it?" I offered.
"No." "Well, one day," I went on, knowing that really he wanted to hear, "a group of locals at Daintree got together for a festive pre-Christmas barbie, when some of them decided to go for a cooling dip in the Daintree River. The river was known to be the home of crocodiles, but none had ever attacked anybody locally. So several of the party scampered down to the water's edge, stripped to their underwear, and splashed in. Ms. Ruck apparently thought better of leaping in, so she merely stepped a foot or so into the water. As she stood there watching the happy frolicking, she idly leaned over and trailed a hand through the water. Just at that instant, the water split in a flash of movement, and poor Mizrock was gone, never to be seen again. "There was no sound, no scream," reported one witness. "It was so quick that if you had blinked an eye, you'd have missed the whole thing." That is what a crocodile attack is like, you see. Swift, unexpected, extremely irreversible. "And you're telling me there are crocodiles here in this water," Alan said. "Oh, I don't know whether there are or not," I replied, "but it's why I'm letting you walk on the inside." Just then, from the restive skies, there came a single startling crack of thunder. Abruptly, the wind kicked up, sending the palm trees dancing, and a few fat splats of rain fell. Then the skies opened in a warm but soaking downpour. We hied back to our hotel, where we took refuge under the veranda of the beachfront bar, ineffectually wrung out our steaming shirts, and watched the rain beat down with a tumultuous fury. There was nothing so dainty as raindrops in this. It was just a cubic mass of falling water, filling the world with a fearful pounding din. I had thought that growing up in the American Midwest, I was familiar with lively weather, but I am happy to concede that where the elements are concerned, Australia plays in a league of its own. I had never seen anything like it. "So let me get this straight," Alan was saying. "We can't go to Cooktown because we can't get through. We can't swim because the ocean's full of deadly jellyfish, and the road to Cairns might be cut off at any moment." "That's about the size of it," I replied. He blew out thoughtfully. "Might as well have a few beers, then." He went off to get some. I took a seat at a small table on the veranda and watched the rain pour down. One of the bar employees came and stood in the doorway. "Worst wet in 30 years," he said. I nodded. "What's the forecast?" "Same." I nodded bleakly. "We were supposed to be going out to the Great Barrier Reef tomorrow." "Oh, you've got no worries there. They don't cancel the reef tours unless it's a hurricane." "People go out to the reef in this kind of weather?" I asked. He nodded. The water in the bay was sloshing around like a bath into which a fat man had just jumped.
"Why?"
"How much did you pay for your tickets?" he asked. I had no idea. Everything had been booked as part of a package. But I had the tickets with me and pulled them out of my wallet.
$145 each," I squeaked in miserly disbelief.
He smiled. "There you go." He went back in. A moment later, Alan reappeared with the beers, looking unusually dejected. "There is a jellyfish called the snotty," he said in wonder. "The barman told me." I gave him an apologetic smile. "Told you." He stared for some minutes at the rain. On the table, someone had left a copy of the local paper, the Port Douglas and Mossman Gazette. Alan started to move it to get at the ashtray. Then something caught his eye. He read for a minute, with increasing absorption, then wordlessly passed the paper to me, tapping the article he wished me to see. It was a small story at the bottom of the front page, noting that the dengue fever epidemic in Port Douglas had slowed at last. The article noted that since the epidemic had started, 485 cases had been reported in the area. Although the pace was slowing, this was not grounds for complacency, a spokeswoman for the Tropical Public Health Unit warned. "It's at the bottom of the page," he said, his eyes just a trifle wild. "That's where we're going tomorrow," I noted with idle interest. "Do you have any idea what a dengue epidemic would be like in Britain? People would be nailing boards over their windows. Ferries would have people hanging off the sides trying to get out of the country. The police would have to shoot people in the streets to restore order. Here they get 485 cases in a single community, and it's 2 bloody inches on the bottom of the page. Where have you brought me, Bryson? What kind of country is this?"
"Oh, it's a wonderful country, Alan."
"Yeah, right." We split up to shower and change, then reconvened in the bar for an aperitif before dinner. As the rain showed no sign of easing, we decided to dine at the hotel. At dinner, Alan ordered red snapper. "You've not heard of Ciguatera, then?" I said casually. "Of course I haven't bloody heard of it," he replied through clenched teeth. "What now?" It's nothing, I said. Of course it must be something, or you wouldn't have mentioned it. What is it? Am I sitting in it? Is it on my head? What? No, it's a kind of toxin endemic to tropical waters. It accumulates in certain fish, like red snapper, for instance. Well, especially red snapper, actually. He considered this with a kind of slow, catatonic nod. I think jet lag was kicking in. It can do terrible things to one's equilibrium. I'm sure there's nothing to worry about, I added reassuringly. I mean, if there was an outbreak, snapper wouldn't be on the menu, would it? Unless, of course. I stopped there. What? He said. Well, unless you were to be the first case. It has to start with somebody, after all. But hey, what are the chances of that? 1 in 100? 1 in 20? I want you to stop this right now, he said. Of course, I agreed at once. I'm sorry. Do you want to change your order? No. The symptoms include, but are not limited to, vomiting, severe muscle weakness, loss of motor control, paresthesia of the lips, general lassitude, myalgia, and paradoxical sensory disturbances. That is, feeling hot surfaces as cold, and vice versa. Death occurs in about 12% of cases. I'm telling you to stop it right now, Alan said. The waitress came with our drinks. This snapper, Alan said with forced casualness. It's all right, is it? Oh, yeah, it's beaut, she replied. I mean, it hasn't got... What is it, Bryson? Ciguatera. She gave us a befuddled look. No, it comes with chips and salad. We exchanged glances. Would I be right in assuming you're not from around here? I asked. Her puzzlement deepened. No, I'm from Tassie. Why? Just wondered. I whispered to Alan, she's from Tasmania. He leaned to me and whispered back. Yes, so? Their snapper are okay. Is it possible to change my order, love? Alan asked. She stared at him heavily for a moment, the way young people do when they realize they're being asked to take 20 steps they hadn't budgeted for, and with a martyred air went off to find out. A minute later she reported back that permission had been granted to change his order. Excellent, said Alan with sudden enthusiasm, perusing the menu anew. He considered the many alternative options. Do you do baked snotty? He asked distantly. She stared at him. Just joking, he said, seeming much chirpier. I'll have the sirloin and chips, he announced. Medium rare, please. He turned to me. No horrid diseases I should know about with regard to beef? Queensland beef palsy or anything like that? You should be fine with steak, I said. Steak it is, then. He handed her the menu. And easy on the ciguatera, he called after her. And keep the beers coming, he added further. We had a lovely meal, and afterward retired once more to the bar, where, through the foolish wonders of alcohol, we managed to acquire nearly all the symptoms that we had so recently been at pains to avoid. In the morning the rain had stopped, but the skies were dark and dirty, and the sea full of chop. Just looking at it made me feel faintly ill. I am not enamored of the ocean or anything within it, and the prospect of bouncing 38 nautical miles to a rain-shrouded reef to see the sort of darting fish I could view in comfort at any public aquarium, or indeed dental waiting room, was not enticing. According to the morning paper, a 2.3-meter swell was expected. I asked Alan, who once owned a sailboat and a captain's cap, and thus fancies himself an accomplished mariner, how big this was, and he lifted his eyebrows in the manner of one impressed. Oh, that's big, he said. This led him to tell me many happy anecdotes of being pitched about in terrifying seas, some of them involving boats not tied to a dock. As we sat there, one of the members of the staff breezed past. Cyclone coming, she said perkily. Today, I asked in what was becoming a customary bleat. Maybe. Our reef tour included pickup at our hotel and transfer by bus to the boat at Port Douglas, 20 miles up the coast. The bus drew up at 8:50, on time to the minute. As we climbed aboard, the driver was giving a rundown on marine stingers, with vivid descriptions of people who had failed to their cost to heed the warning signs. He assured us, however, there were no jellyfish on the reef. Unaccountably, he failed to mention reef sharks, boxfish, scorpionfish, stinging corals, sea snakes, or the fat and infamous grouper, a 900-pound monster that occasionally, through a combination of testiness and stupidity, chomps off a swimmer's arm, then remembers that it doesn't like the taste of human flesh. I can't tell you how pleased I was when we arrived at Port Douglas to find that the boat was huge, as big as an English Channel ferry, or very nearly, and sleekly new. I was also pleased, for their sake and mine, that none of the crew seemed to be manifesting any of the more obvious signs of dengue fever. As we lined up with other arriving coach passengers, I learned from a crew member that the ship held 450, and that 310 people were booked today. He also told me that the trip to the reef took 90 minutes, and that the seas should be relatively benign. It was 38 nautical miles to Agincourt Reef, where we would moor. This was, I noted with more than passing interest, the place where the American couple had gone missing. When we got aboard, they announced the free distribution of seasickness tablets to anyone who wanted. I was the first to the table. "This is awfully thoughtful of you," I said as I swilled down a handful. "Well, it's better than having people spewing up all over the shop," said the girl brightly, and it was hard to argue with that. The trip to the reef was smooth, as promised. What's more, the sun came out, albeit weakly, turning the water from a leaden gray to an approximation of cobalt. While Alan went off to the sun deck to see if there were any women with large breasts to look at, I settled down with my notes. Depending on which sources you consult, the Great Barrier Reef covers 280,000 square kilometers or 344,000, or something in between. Stretches 1,200 miles from top to bottom, or 1,600. Is bigger than Kansas, or Italy, or the United Kingdom. Nobody can agree, really, on where the barrier reef begins and ends, though everyone agrees it's awfully big. Even by the shortest measure, it is equivalent in length to the west coast of the United States. And it is, of course, an immensely vital habitat, the oceanic equivalent of the Amazon rainforest. The Great Barrier Reef contains at least 1,500 species of fish, 400 types of coral, and 4,000 varieties of mollusks, but those are essentially just guesses. No one has ever attempted a comprehensive survey. Too big a job. Because it consists of some 3,000 separate reefs and over 600 islands, some people insist that it is not a single entity, and therefore cannot accurately be termed the largest living thing on Earth. That seems to me a little like saying that Los Angeles is not a city because it consists of lots of separate buildings. It hardly matters. It is fabulous, and it is all thanks to trillions of little coral polyps working with a dedicated and microscopic diligence over 18 million years, each adding a grain or two of thickness before expiring in a self-created silicate tomb. Hard not to be impressed. As the ship began to make the sort of slowing down noises that suggested imminent arrival, I went out on deck to join Alan. I had expected that we would be arriving at some kind of sandy atoll, possibly with a beach bar with a thatched roof, but in fact there was nothing but open sea all around, and a long rough of gently breaking water, which I presumed indicated the sunken and unseen reef. In the middle of this scene sat an immense aluminum pontoon, 2 stories high and big enough to accommodate 400 day-trippers. It brought to mind, if vaguely, an oil platform. This was to be our home for the next several hours. When the boat had docked, we all filed happily off. A loudspeaker outlined our many options. We could loll in the sun in deck chairs, or descend to an underwater viewing chamber, or grab snorkels and flippers for a swim, or board a semi-submersible ship for a tour of the reef in comfort. We went first on the semi-submersible, a vessel into which people could crowd into a viewing chamber below the waterline. Well, it was wonderful. No matter how much you read about the special nature of the barrier reef, nothing really prepares you for the sight of it. The pilot took us into a shimmery world of steep coral canyons and razor-edged defiles, fabulously colorful and teeming with schools of fish of incredible variety and size. Butterfly fish, damsel fish, angel fish, parrot fish, the gorgeously colorful harlequin tusk fish, tubular pipe fish. We saw giant clams and sea slugs and starfish, small forests of waving anemones, and the pleasingly large and dopey potato cod. It was, as I had expected, precisely like being at a public aquarium, except, of course, that this was entirely wild and natural. I was amazed, no doubt foolishly, by what a difference this made. As I looked out, a great turtle swam past, just a couple of yards from the window, and quite indifferent to us. Then, furtively poking about on the bottom, was a reef shark, only a couple of feet long, but capable of giving you a jolly good nip. It wasn't just the darting fish and other creatures, but the way the light filtered down from above, and the shape and texture and incredible variety of the coral itself. I was captivated beyond description. Back on the pontoon, Alan insisted we go at once for a swim. At one side of the pontoon, metal steps led into the water. At the top of the steps were large bins containing flippers, snorkels, and masks. We suited up and plopped in. I had assumed that we would be in a few feet of water, so I was taken aback, I'm putting this mildly, to discover that I was perhaps 60 feet above the bottom. I had never been in water this deep before, and it was unexpectedly unnerving, as unnerving as finding myself floating 60 feet in the air above solid ground. This panicky assessment took place over the course of perhaps 3 seconds, then my mask and snorkel filled with water, and I started choking. Gasping peevishly, I dumped the water out and tried again, but almost immediately the mask filled again. I repeated the exercise 2 or 3 times more, but with the same result. Alan, meanwhile, was shooting about like Daryl Hannah in Splash. "For God's sake, Bryson, what are you doing?" he said. "You're 3 feet from the pontoon and you're drowning." "I am drowning," I replied. I caught a roll of wave full in the face and came out of it sputtering. "I'm a son of the soil," I gasped. "This is not my milieu." He clucked and disappeared. I dipped my head lightly under to see him shooting off like a torpedo in the direction of a colorful Maori wrasse, an angelfish the size of a sofa cushion, and was consumed once more with a bubbly dismay at all the clear, unimagined depth beneath me. There were big things down there, too, fish half as big as me and far more in their element than I was. Then my mask filled, and I was sputtering again. Then another small rolling wave smacked me in the face. I must confess that I liked this even less, quite a good deal less, than I had expected to, and I hadn't expected to like it much. Interestingly, I later learned that this is quite a common reaction among inexperienced ocean swimmers. They get in the water, discover that they are way out of their comfort zone, quietly panic, and faint, a Japanese specialty, apparently, or have a heart attack, a fat person's specialty. Now here's where the second interesting aspect comes in. Because snorkelers lie on the water with their arms and legs spread and their faces just under the surface, that is, in the posture known as the dead man's float, it isn't actually possible, or so I am told, to tell which people are snorkeling and which are dead. It's only when the whistle blows and everyone gets out except for one oddly inert and devoted soul that they know there will be one less for tea. Fortunately, as you will have deduced from the existence of this program, I escaped this unhappy fate and managed to haul myself back onto the pontoon. I took a seat on a deck chair in the mild sunshine and toweled off with Alan's shirt. Then I pulled out the newspaper files Alan Howe had given me on the American couple who had died out there. I had read them once before, but now that I could attach visible landmarks to the words, I went through them again with particular interest. The story, insofar as the known events are concerned, is straightforward. In January 1998, Thomas and Eileen Lonergan, of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who had recently completed a tour of duty as Peace Corps volunteers in the South Pacific, were vacationing in Australia before returning home, when they went for a day's scuba diving on the reef with a company called Outer Edge. At the end of the afternoon, they failed to return to the dive boat at the time directed. The dive crew failed to note their absence and left without them. 2.5 days passed before anyone reported them missing. No trace of them was ever found. Why the Lonergans didn't return to the dive boat, and what became of them when they realized they had been stranded, are necessarily matters of conjecture. From where I sat, I could see the scuba diving boat, which a passing crew member informed me was about 3 nautical miles away. A nautical mile is about 100 yards longer than a land mile. It looked awfully small and distant, but the Lonergans, who were experienced divers and at home in the water, should have found the swim no terrible hardship. Conditions were perfect. The sea was calm, the water temperature was 29 degrees centigrade, 84 degrees Fahrenheit, and they had on wetsuits. In addition to the pontoon, they had the somewhat easier option of swimming to St. Crispin Reef, just 1.2 nautical miles away, where there were some exposed coral outcrops onto which they could clamber to await rescue. The problem, as Alan Howe had so rightly recalled, was that to reach either of these refuges meant crossing a deep-water trench known to be a haunt of large pelagians, which is to say toothy sharks, and the occasional blundering grouper. From this point, the mystery deepened. A few days after their disappearance, the Lonergan's flotation jackets washed up undamaged on a mainland beach. Why two people stranded at sea would take off their flotation devices would appear to be an unanswerable question. Moreover, the absence of damage to the flotation jackets suggested that they had not been attacked by sharks. Puzzlement grew further when police examined the belongings they had left behind at the backpackers' hostel in Cairns, where they had been staying. There it became clear that the polite young American couple weren't as happy as they appeared to be. Eileen Lonergan had recorded in her diary that her husband had been depressed and said he wanted to end it all on a scuba diving trip. Whoa. He had suggested that he would take her with him. Double woe. There was obviously more to this than met the eye. Alan emerged at last, looking invigorated and holding in his stomach in a manner that recalled Jeff Chandler and some of his later films, chattering with tedious gusto about what a brilliant experience it had been, and what an egregious wimp I was. He slipped on his shirt and fell into the chair beside me, looking very happy. Then he sat up and patted himself extravagantly. "This shirt's wet," he announced. "Is it?" I said, frowning with concern. "It's wringing wet." I touched it lightly. "Why, yes, it is," I agreed. They were losing people all over the place in Queensland these days, it appeared. The papers the next day were full of reports of an inquest that had been convened to examine the disappearance of a young British backpacker named Daniel Newt on the Cape Tribulation Promontory almost 2 years earlier. Newt had set off alone on a 6-hour hike to a place called Mount Sorrow, and had dutifully filled out the safety forms bush hikers are asked to complete to help searchers in the event that they fail to return. Unfortunately, no one from the National Park staff collected or checked the safety sheets that day. In fact, it turned out that no one from the National Park staff ever collected or checked the safety sheets. So when Newt failed to return, no one noticed, and no alarm call went out. Even more puzzling was that although Newt had left a tent pitched on the grounds of a backpacker's lodge in Daintree, the staff at the lodge did not notify the authorities that he was missing for 23 days. An employee at the lodge told the inquest that it was common for people to abandon their tents and leave without telling management. But of course. The upshot is that by the time a search was organized, almost a month had passed. Newt's body has never been found. All this took on a certain relevance the next morning when Alan and I drove into Cairns to run a couple of errands. Something in the window of a sportswear shop caught his eye, so we went in. While he was off trying on items of clothing, I chatted pleasantly with the two middle-aged women who work there. I mentioned for no reason, just making conversation really, that Cairns had been much in the news lately. "Oh," said one of the women, a little coolly. "You know, the Lonergan case and the Chinese boat people and this poor kid who went missing at Daintree." "Oh, all that," said the lady with a dismissive air. "They always blow these things out of proportion down south." Her colleague nodded vigorously. "Whenever there's a chance to make Queensland look bad, they leap on it. It was just the same with the cyclone. I was in Sydney that week visiting my sister, and you know they had pages of articles about it." "Well, it was a big story," I pointed out. "But they wouldn't have covered it like that if it had been in Western Australia." "Oh?" I said. "No, they do it to discourage people from coming up here, you see." "You really think so?" "Oh, yes. They don't want visitors to leave Sydney. They want to keep them down there. So they take any story that makes Queensland look, you know, dangerous or backward, and they twist the facts about to frighten people. They both nodded in the sincerest agreement. It was the same with that young couple out on the reef. It's quite evident that it was suicide, but they blew it all out of proportion. All out of proportion, seconded her friend, so that they could make it look like it wasn't safe to go out on the reef.
And the boy at Daintree, I ventured?
They don't know that he's dead at all, she said in the tone of one who has unimpeachable sources.
But he's been missing for 2 years.
Yes, but he's been sighted all over the Cape York Peninsula.
All over, agreed her friend.
I'm sorry, are you saying the papers falsely reported his death to make Queensland look dangerous?
I'm just saying that all the facts aren't in.
She nodded primly and crossed her arms. Her partner did likewise. And I thought, madder than cut snakes.
As it happened, we were heading to Daintree ourselves. It was as far north as you could get on a paved road in this part of Australia, so we decided to go and have a look. By mid-morning, all traces of rain had abated, and the sun began to come out, tentatively at first, but then with sumptuous gusto. Queensland was transformed. Suddenly we were in Hawaii, tropical mountains running down to sparkling seas, sweeping bays, flawless beaches guarded by listing palms, little green and rocky islands standing off the headlands. From time to time we drove through sunny cane fields, overlooked by the steep blue eminence of the Great Dividing Range. At Daintree we parked and got out to have a look around. We walked down to the edge of the Daintree River, where both the road and Barrel Rock came to their respective abrupt terminations. We couldn't see any sign of crocodiles. Then we got back in the car and drove off down a winding side road that leads to a ferry across the Daintree to Cape Tribulation. The ferry had been shut for a week by the rains, so there wasn't much point in going down there, but I wanted to see the Cape at least from across the river, and there was the off chance that we might glimpse a crocodile. To our surprise, the ferry was operating. We had been assured in Daintree that it was still shut.
"Reopened yesterday," said the ferryman, a man of few words.
So we took the ferry across and set off on the 20-mile drive to Cape Tribulation through Daintree National Park. The road wound up and through a mountainous and intensely beautiful rainforest. We had at last made it into the wet tropics, and I couldn't have been more pleased. The Daintree Forest is a remnant of a time when the world was a single landmass, the whole covered in steamy growth. As time passed, continents split up and drifted off to the far corners of the globe, but the Daintree, through some tectonic fluke, escaped the more dramatic changes of climate and orientation that spurred ecological change elsewhere. In consequence, there are plants out there, whole families of plants, that survive as nowhere else. In 1972, scientists began to appreciate just how ancient and exceptional Australia's northern rainforest is when some cattle mysteriously sickened and died after grazing in the jungle's lower slopes. The cows, it turned out, had been poisoned by the seeds of a tree called Idiospermum australiense. What was unexpected about this was that Idiospermum was thought to have vanished from the earth 100 million years ago. In fact, it was doing very well in the Daintree, as were 11 other members of its family, a primitive outpost of botany called the angiosperms, from which all flowering plants are descended. That's the kind of place Daintree National Park is, dark, dense, seeming to belong to some remote epoch. It's a landscape in which it wouldn't entirely surprise you to see pterosaurs gliding through the trees or velociraptors sprinting across the road ahead. In fact, there is quite a lot of odd life out there. This is one of the few remaining areas where you can hope to see cassowaries. They look much like emus, except that they have a bony growth on their head called a casque, and the infamous murderous claw on each foot. They attack by jumping up and striking out with both feet together. Fortunately, this doesn't happen very often. The last fatal attack was in 1926, when a cassowary charged a 16-year-old boy who had been taunting it and sliced open his jugular vein as it bounded across him. The reason attacks are so few is that cassowaries are exceedingly reclusive and now, alas, very few in number. No more than 1,000 of them survive. The Daintree is also one of the last homes of the celebrated tree kangaroo, which, as its name suggests, is a kangaroo that lives in trees. But it is even shyer than the cassowary and almost never seen. So dense is the jungle, and so remote from the centers of academia, that much of it remains unstudied. The first scientific study of cassowaries, for instance, was only begun about a decade ago. At length the road ended at a sunny clearing in the jungle with, incongruously, a takeout food stand and a phone booth. Tucked away in the extravagant foliage was a campground, and beside it an arrowed sign pointed the way to the beach. This led to a boardwalk through mangroves. Little creatures plinked unseen into the swampy water as we approached. After a few minutes we emerged onto the beach. It was remarkably beautiful. A great sweep of soft white sand strewn with driftwood, palm fronds, and other natural clutter, standing before a very bright blue bay. Ahead of us loomed a towering headland, cloaked in green. The spot was sunnily pristine, exactly as it must have appeared to James Cook when he first laid eyes on it more than 2 centuries ago. He called it Cape Tribulation, because it was here that the Endeavour disastrously lodged on coral, some 12 miles off the coast. Severely holed, it was in imminent danger of sinking, but Cook had with him a seaman who had once been in similar straits on a ship that had been saved by an unusual process known as fathering, in effect bandaging the underside of the ship by running a sail underneath it and pulling tight to cover the hole. It was a desperate and improbable measure, but miraculously it worked. Cook nursed the ship to shore a few miles around the headland from where we were now. The crew spent 7 weeks making repairs before sailing off to England and glory. Had the Endeavour sunk and Cook failed to get home, history would, of course, have been very different. Australia would very likely have become French, an eerie thought to say the least, and Britain would have had to adjust its colonial ambitions accordingly. No part of the world would have escaped the effects. Melbourne might now stand on African plains. Sydney could be the capital of the Royal Colony of California. Who can possibly say? What is certain is that the global balance of power would have changed in ways beyond imagining. On the other hand, we would almost certainly have been spared the Bee Gees, so it's not as if it would have been an unmitigated disaster. Alan and I explored along the beach for half an hour or so, then walked back to the clearing where the food stand was, and had a look at where the road continued on to Cooktown. Beyond the food stand, it became at once a rough and rocky track, which climbed steeply up into the lush hills. It looked like something Harrison Ford would struggle to negotiate in an adventure movie. I had learned only the day before that the track is dangerously and unnervingly tippy, even in good weather, so perhaps it was as well that Alan and I hadn't been let loose on it. In any case, it was impassable now. Still, it did look awfully inviting in an adventuresome sort of way. Cooktown, a former gold mining town that once had a population of 30,000 and has just 200 now, lay 75 kilometers away on the other side of the mountains. It is the last town in eastern Australia. Beyond it, there is nothing but a scattering of Aboriginal settlements along the 600-kilometer track to Cape York, Australia's northernmost point. But this was as far as I was going to get here. I turned around to discover that Alan had slipped off. He reappeared after a minute from the direction of the food stand, bearing 2 cans of Coke, one of which he passed to me. "They didn't have urine," he said, and we both had a good laugh over that. Chapter 15. And so to the top end. We bounced into Darwin through the outer strands of 2 minor cyclones that were bumping along the north coast, and acquired another rental car, a sleek and powerful Toyota sedan that looked as if it could cover the 1,500 kilometers to Alice Springs in a single rocket-like burst. We dubbed it the Testosterone. The Northern Territory has always had something of a frontier mentality. In late 1998, the inhabitants were invited to become Australia's 7th state, and roundly rejected the notion in a referendum. It appears they quite like being outsiders. In consequence, an area of 523,000 square miles, or about 1/5 of the country, is in Australia but not entirely of it. This throws up some interesting anomalies. All Australians are required by law to vote in federal elections, including residents of the Northern Territory. However, since the Northern Territory is not a state, it has no seats in Parliament. So the Territorians elect representatives who go to Canberra and attend sessions of Parliament, at least that's what they say in their letters home, but don't actually vote or take part or have any consequence at all. Even more interestingly, during national referendums, the citizens of the Northern Territory are also required to vote, but the votes don't actually count toward anything. They're just put in a drawer or something. Seems a little odd to me, but then, as I say, the people seem content with the arrangement. Personally, I feel that the Territorians should not be permitted to take full part in national affairs until they get friendlier hotel staff in Darwin. This might seem a curious basis on which to found a political philosophy, but there you are. Darwin's hoteliers are seriously deficient in the charm department, and if it takes the withholding of certain civil liberties to get them to address the problem, then I think that is a small charge to exact, frankly. Our troubles began when we went looking for our hotel. We were booked into a place called the All Seasons Frontier Hotel, but no such establishment appeared to exist. The guidebook mentioned a top-end frontier hotel, and a tourist leaflet I acquired at the airport listed a Darwin City Frontier Hotel. And yet another listed an all-seasons premier Darwin Central Hotel. All of these we spied, distantly, as we drove around for the next 40 minutes, squabbling quietly in the manner of a fractious married couple. We stopped about half a dozen pedestrians, but none had heard of an all-seasons frontier hotel, except one man who thought it was at Kakadu, 200 kilometers to the east. With the aid of a small, inadequate map, I directed Alan down a series of streets, which proved always to end at a pedestrianized zone or a cul-de-sac of loading bays, to his increasing exasperation. "Can you not read a simple map?" he asked in the peevish tone of a man whose happy hour needs are going unmet, reversing into cardboard boxes and wheelie bins. "No," I replied in kind. "I cannot read a simple map. I can read a good map. This map, however, is useless. Less than useless. It is the print equivalent of your driving, if I may say so." Eventually, we stopped outside a large hotel on the seafront, and Alan ordered me to go inside and seek professional guidance. At the front desk, a young man who had evidently invested a recent paycheck in a very large tub of hair gel stood with his back to me, regaling two female colleagues with some droll anecdote. I waited a long minute, then went, "Ahem." He turned his head to give me a look that said, without warmth, "What?" "Could you point me to the All Seasons Frontier Hotel?" I asked politely. Without preamble, he reeled off a series of complex directions. Darwin is full of strange street names. Cavanaugh, Ewan, Fulsh, Nucky, and I couldn't begin to follow. On the counter was a pad of maps, and I asked him if he could show me on that. "It's too far to walk," he said dismissively, and just a bit oddly. "I don't want to walk. I've got a car." "Then ask your driver to take you." He rolled his eyes for the benefit of the girls, then continued with his story. How I longed for a small firearm, or perhaps a set of industrial tongs with which to clamp his reedy neck and draw his head close to me, the better to hear what I next had to say. It was, "Do you think if I had a driver, I would be asking directions of you? It's a rental car, you snide, irksome, preposterously glossy little shit." I may not have said the words precisely in that order, or indeed at all, but that was certainly the emotional gist of it. With sullen gaze and a long sigh, he took a pen and rapidly but vaguely sketched the route on the map, tore it from the pad, and handed it over as if giving me a voucher to which I had no right. 10 minutes later, we pulled up outside a hotel that announced itself, in large letters, as the Darwin City Frontier Hotel. We had passed it several times already, but I had confidently rejected it on each occasion. I stalked through the front doors. "Is this the All Seasons Frontier Hotel?" I barked from an unsocial distance. The young woman behind the counter looked up and blinked. "Yes," she said. "Then," I came much closer, "why don't you put up a sign saying so?" She regarded me lovely. "It says it on the side of the building." "Well, it doesn't," I said.
She favored me with a thin, knowing, supremely condescending smile.
Yes, it does.
Well, it doesn't. Torn between her training in customer relations and her youthful certitude, she hesitated, and in a soft voice said,
"Does."
I held up a finger in a way that said, "Don't move. Don't go anywhere. I'm going to check this out and then come back and throttle someone. You, actually." I went out and ranged around the building in the manner of a demented building inspector, examining it from every angle and from various distances, held up a silencing finger to Alan, who watched bewildered from the driver's seat, then came back in and announced, "It doesn't say all seasons on it anywhere." She looked at me and said nothing, but I could see she was thinking, "Does." I am happy to let the record show that by whatever name it goes, the Darwin City Frontier Hotel was a wondrously inept and disappointing establishment. It was overpriced, charmless, and inconveniently sited. The TV in my room didn't work, the pillows were concrete slabs, and the receptionist was irritating. This was not the Australia I had come to respect and adore. To get to the hotel bar, we discovered after much blind experimentation and a further interview with our young friend at the front desk, it was necessary to descend by a back stairway to the basement, find our way through some storage areas, leave the building, and present ourselves at a pair of automatic sliding doors, which weren't working. Alan, who was not a man to let any impediment stand between him and his evening beverage, yanked them open with a vehemence that was impressive, and we squeezed through. The bar was liberally, not to say unexpectedly, arrayed with rough, boisterously drunk, and dangerous-looking fellows, all with copious tattoos, long hair, and beards like mattress ticking. Not exactly the patrons you would expect to find drinking in the bar of a business hotel. "Like a fucking ZZ Top convention," Alan muttered darkly but correctly. We procured a couple of beers and sat primly in a corner, like two old maids at an inner-city bus station, and watched as two of the burlier of the fellows played a game of pool in which each disappointing shot, and there seemed to be almost no other kind, was accompanied by a whack of cue across something metallic or unyielding. The pool table, a chair back, the swinging light above the table. It seemed only a matter of time before flesh and bone came into the equation. We decided to repair to the rooftop restaurant on the 7th floor, in search of a more serene and composed environment. The restaurant was a large room with big windows giving expansive views over Darwin by twilight. Of the perhaps 50 tables in the room, no more than 3 or 4 were occupied. So it came as a surprise when the hostess informed us, with a look of stark panic, that no tables were available at the moment. "But it's practically empty," I pointed out. "I'm sorry, but we've got a terrible rush on." As if to underline the urgency of the situation, she flew off. We took a seat at the bar and had 2 more beers, which we coaxed out of a cheerful Indonesian fellow who sometimes wandered past, and may actually have been an employee. After another 30 minutes and further inquiries, we were finally granted a table by a far window. There we sat for 10 minutes more, until a waitress came out and plonked in front of each of us a small standard terracotta flower pot, in which had been baked a little loaf of bread. "What's this?" I asked.
"It's bread," she replied.
"But it's in a flower pot." She gave me a look that I was beginning to think of as the Darwin stare. It was a look that said, "Yeah, so?" "Well, isn't that kind of unusual?" I said. She considered for a moment. "Is a bit, I suppose. And will we be following a horticultural theme throughout the meal?" Her expression contorted in a deeply pained look, as if she were trying to suck her face into the back of her head. "What? Will the main course arrive in a wheelbarrow?" I elaborated helpfully. "Will you be serving the salad with a pitchfork?" "Oh, no, it's just the bread that's special. I'm so pleased to hear it." Before we could take our relationship to the next stage and ask for drinks or perhaps a menu, she was gone, announcing as she went that she would be back when she could, but that there was a bit of a rush on. There then followed the most extraordinary evening in which, each time we hankered for food or additional refreshment or just the sound of an Australian voice, we had to go off and stand by the kitchen doors until we caught someone emerging. Some of the other few diners were doing likewise.
During one foray, I asked a man with an empty beer glass if he dined here often.
"Wife likes the view," he explained, and we looked across the room to a plump little woman who gave us a small but cheery wave.
"Service is a bit slow, don't you think?"
"Bloody hopeless," he agreed. "They've got some kind of rush on, apparently."
In the morning, a new man was behind the front desk.
"And how did you enjoy your stay, sir?" he asked smoothly.
"It was singularly execrable," I replied.
"Oh, excellent," he purred, taking my card.
"In fact, I would go so far as to say that the principal value of a stay in this establishment is that it is bound to make all subsequent service-related experiences seem, in comparison, refreshing."
He made a deeply appreciative expression, as if to say, "Praise indeed," and presented my bill for signature.
"Well, we hope you'll come again."
"I would sooner have bowel surgery in the woods with a stick," I said. His expression wavered, then held there for a long moment.
"Excellent," he said again, but without a great show of conviction.
We went into town to look around. Darwin is in the steamy heart of the tropics, which to my mind imposes certain stylistic requirements. White buildings with verandas, louvered windows, potted palms, lazy ceiling fans, cool drinks in tall glasses presented by obsequious houseboys, men in white suits and Panama hats, women in floral print cotton dresses, a little mahjong to pass the sultry afternoons, Sydney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre in evidence somewhere, looking hot and shifty. Anything that falls short of these simple ideals will always leave me disappointed, and Darwin failed in every respect. To be fair, the place has been knocked about a good deal. It was bombed repeatedly by the Japanese in World War II, and then devastated by Cyclone Tracy in 1974, so much of it is necessarily new. Even so, there was almost nothing to suggest a particular climatic affiliation. We could have been in Wollongong or Bendigo or any other moderately prosperous provincial city. The one small local peculiarity was that there seemed to be no one about of professional demeanor. Nearly every person on the streets was bearded and tattooed and scuffed along with a wino shuffle, as if some very large mission had just turned everyone out for the day. Here and there, too, were scatterings of aborigines, shadowy and furtive, sitting quietly on the margins of sunny plazas, as if in a waiting room. While Alan went off to get some money out of a bank machine, I drifted into the vicinity of three aboriginal people, two men and a woman, all staring at nothing. I gave them a nod and respectful good day smile as I passed, but failed signally to establish eye contact. It was as if they were somewhere else, or I was transparent. We had breakfast in a small Italian cafe, the only customers, then drove out to the Museum and Art Gallery of the Northern Territory, because I had read that it had a box jellyfish on display. I had expected the museum to be small and dusty, and to detain us for no longer than it took to find and briefly examine the jellyfish, but in fact it was sleek and modern and quite wonderful. It was improbably large for a provincial museum, and chock-full of interesting stuff thoughtfully presented. One area was devoted to Cyclone Tracy, still the most devastating natural event in Australian history. It all but blew away the town on Christmas Eve 1974. According to a recorded commentary, most people didn't expect the storm to come to much. A weaker cyclone had passed through a few weeks earlier without doing significant damage, and the leading edge of Tracy brushed over the town without leaving any hint of particular ferocity to come. Most people turned in as if it were a normal night. It wasn't until Darwin was hit by the back end of the storm system, about 2:30 a.m., that people realized they were really in for it. As the winds whipped up to 160 miles an hour, Darwin's frail tropical houses began to shed pieces and then to disintegrate. Most of the housing was post-war fiberboard homes of a type called the D-series, which were cheap and quick to build, but could not stand up to a real hurricane. Before the night was out, Tracy had blown away 9,000 homes and killed more than 60 people. Just off the main display area was a small darkened chamber in which you could listen to a tape recording of the storm that had been made on the night by a Roman Catholic priest. A sign on the door warned that people who had lived through the storm might find the recording distressing, which I thought perhaps a trifle overwrought, until I heard it myself. Well, it was an amazingly effective way of making you realize how powerful and terrifying such a storm can be. The recording began with various lively but clearly preliminary wind noises, branches knocking, gates banging, and then rose and rose again till it was a continuous howling, unearthly fury, with sounds of metal roofs being wrenched from their moorings and other weighty debris flying murderously through the night. Experiencing it in pitch darkness, as the locals would have done, gave it an immediacy that was inexpressibly effective. I actually found myself ducking whenever anything crashed nearby. When it finished, Alan and I exchanged impressed and drained looks and proceeded onto the visual part of the display with a new appreciation. On a wall outside, a television endlessly showed the original Australian Broadcasting Corporation footage of what the town woke up to the next day, namely total devastation. The film, taken from a slow-moving car, showed street after street in which every structure was flattened. Much of the rest of the museum was given over to cases of stuffed animals, illustrating the Northern Territory's extraordinary biological diversity. Pride of place was given to an enormous stuffed crocodile named Sweetheart, who was, for a time, the most famous in Australia. Sweetheart, who was, despite the effeminate name, a male, had a passionate dislike for outboard engines and used to attack any boats that disturbed his peace. Unusually for a crocodile, he never harmed a person, but he crunched at least 15 boats and their motors, bringing a certain unexpected liveliness to many a fisherman's afternoon. In 1979, when it was feared that he would do himself some serious harm, he was constantly being clobbered by propellers, wildlife officials decided to move him somewhere safer. Unfortunately, the capture was botched when a cable snagged and Sweetheart drowned. So he was stuffed and put on display in the Darwin Museum, where he has been impressing visitors ever since with his very substantial heft. He stretches almost 17 feet, and in life weighed more than 1,700 pounds. Another case answered a question that must have occurred to nearly everyone at one time or another, namely, how exactly do they stuff the animals? I had always assumed they filled them with sawdust or old socks or something. Well, here I learned, by means of a small stuffed animal shown in cross-section, that in fact a mounted specimen is empty but for a spare interior framework of styrofoam balls and wooden dowels. I was touched and grateful that some curator had taken the trouble to provide this insight. Also on display were lots of snakes and reptiles, many of them quite severely murderous, which Alan regarded with particular absorption. Perhaps the most admirable quality about the museum, and I suspect this is a real Northern Territory thing, is that it didn't mince words about the dangers of the world outside. Most museums in Australia are at pains to stress the unlikelihood of anything happening to you. The Darwin Museum makes it quite obvious, with cold facts and figures, that if something does happen to you out there, you are really going to regret it. This was most potently displayed in the aquatic creatures section, and here at last we found what we had come to see, a large glass cylinder containing a preserved box jellyfish, the deadliest creature on Earth. It was remarkably unprepossessing, a translucent box-shaped blob, 6 or 8 inches high, with thread-like tentacles several feet long trailing off beneath it. Like all jellyfish, it is all but brainless, but its lethality is unbelievable. The tentacles of a box jellyfish carry enough wallop to kill a room full of people, yet they live exclusively on tiny krill-like shrimp, creatures that hardly require a great deal of violent subduing. As ever in the curious world of Australian biology, no one knows why the jellyfish evolved such extravagant toxicity. Alongside were displays of other dangerous sea creatures, of which the Northern Territory has an impressive plenitude. 5 types of stingrays, 2 of blue-ringed octopus, 30 varieties of sea snakes, 8 types of cone shells, and the usual roguish assortment of stonefish, scorpionfish, firefish, and others too numerous to list and too depressing to dwell on. All these are found in shallow coastal waters, in rock pools, and even sometimes on the beaches themselves. It is a wonder to me that anyone goes within 100 feet of the sea in northern Australia. The sea snakes are especially unnerving, not because they are aggressive, but because they are inquisitive. stray into their territory, and they will come to check you out, all but rubbing against you in the manner of cats seeking affection. They are the most sweet-tempered creatures in existence, but cross them or alarm them, and they can hit you with enough venom to kill 3 grown men. Now that's scary.